Hello, everyone, and welcome to Lit with Vic, the show where I, the titular Vic, try to talk about literature of all forms, such as books, comics, movies, and much more, while fighting the corpse of Lewis Carroll in a dumpster with a fish. Well, maybe not that last bit, but I can hope.
You can hope.
Are any of you listeners in the ether a necromancer or a vampire? I just want to fight that dude in a dumpster so bad. He's a creep. Many of you know my opinions about him.
Your deep disdain for Lewis Carroll.
Yes, my urge to avenge Alice Liddell. In today's episode, we're not talking about Lewis Carroll. We are, however, joined again by everyone's favorite internet hermit and my best friend, Clarissa, for the second episode in our series, where we will discuss Victorian literature and media as part of the seminar we are taking together. All while trying not to go on tangents about greasy-haired Byronic heroes and uranium buttons. See the previous episode about Charles Dickens / Chucky D, and our Secret Garden episode if you want to know what we mean by that.
And doing our best to actually speak loud enough to be heard. Although that one's just me.
And I appreciate you and love you for that. Both as your friend and as the host / audio editor of this podcast, because I do not want to go through your audio manually to make you sound louder.
Bump me up. Just as a bit of an introduction for me, if this is the first episode you're hearing with me in it, I am an eldritch being beyond the comprehension of social media, so if you see me, no you didn't. Today we're going to talk about Dracula, and a very specific Dracula at that. We are talking about Bram Stoker's 1897 novel, Dracula, which is the final book in our shared Victorian literature class.
I wish we were talking about the glorious bisexual wonder that is Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula, though.
Me too. Not that Bram Stoker's is all that much straighter.
But he didn't fan cast Keanu Reeves as Jonathan Harker or Winona Ryder as Mina Murray. So we have to say he could have made it gayer if he could look into the future.
Oh, Jonathan Harker, my poor genre dumb boy, my good, good friend. Can we talk about him? Actually, better yet, let's talk about how we first encountered Dracula. Who or what was your first Dracula?
Who is my, I probably think a bastardized version from a TV show's Halloween special, but I do remember when I first learned about Nosferatu, who is the not-so-legal fanfic version in film. So, yeah, Stoker's widow actually went after the creators of Nosferatu for that, actually. I actually remember seeing him in, like, a clip or something, and then avoiding a specific corner of my childhood basement for years because I was convinced he and other vampires were hiding there. Because it was dark, it was cold, it had, like, damp issues. It wasn't great. It wasn't a good basement. It was creepy. But what about you?
The Count from Sesame Street, if he counts.
Ah, one, two, three. We will see if he counts.
But what about the book? What about the book? Or more direct adaptations. So, like, you know, the actual Dracula movies. Like, I was never a fan of vampires. I wasn't a huge vampire nerd. So I think mine was watching Van Helsing, followed by, like, a number of other movie adaptations. I didn't go for the book.
That is understandable. I'm a reformed Twilight girl, so I think you get the vibe that I like vampires. I was once told that if you looked up the definition of a Twilight fan, that I would be the first image that popped up, waiting to speak to you about battle scars and ask, where have you been, Loka?
We all have our dark hyperfixations.
I have regrets, but at least Twilight brought us Austin Land, so I am grateful for that because I just love Henry Nobley so much, and Jennifer Coolidge is
the queen.
Chef's kiss in that film. But to be honest, I think I knew the image of Dracula before I actually watched a movie or read a book that was not simply a vampire story, but an adaptation.
I think the direct adaptation I first watched has to be the 1991 with Keanu Reeves, and I actually only watched that one last year, Halloween 2021.
At least you had that instead of the horrible Netflix adaptation by Mark Gatiss and Stephen Moffat who did Sherlock. That was burned into my brain and in a very, very bad way. Like, why must Van Helsing be a woman? Why must she and Dracula have sex as the show ends in, like, this weird womb-like moment? My mind is still reeling and horrified at the thought of it. It's bad. It's terrible.
I am allergic to all of these concepts. I think I'm getting hives. Ugh.
I can see you itching yourself.
Ugh. But what about the book? What about the book? I was the one who got you into Dracula Daily last year, which was my first Dracula reading. But unlike me, you had actually already read the book at that point.
Yes, but because I'm a dork and we know that, and I think I read it because of a blog called Food and Literature by Brighton Taylor. She did a few recipes based on Dracula, and since they looked yummy, and I cannot eat a recipe based on a book if I have not read that book, I thought I would read the book and make the recipes as I went. Alas, I'm not a fan of Robert's steak. I refuse to make that because I do not enjoy bell peppers. They are revolting, they are disgusting, they are the garlic to my vampire.
That whole idea is so you. I love it so much. So, but for those not in the know, Dracula Daily was an email-based way to read Dracula. It sent you... So Dracula's written in this style called an epistolary novel, which is diaries, letters, that sort of thing. So mm-hmm. Dracula Daily arranged all of these diary entries, these letters and everything else, into like a chronological order, and then sent them out to you on the day that they were in fiction written.
Yeah.
Essentially telling you the story in real time.
It was basically serializing a book that was never, ever intended or to be serialized at all. And it was so glorious because it was all out of order. It was a lot of fun because you get to read these points that happen much later in the novel, and it's mega confusing. If you want to participate in this act of collective confusion, it'll be coming back again this year, which you should sign up before May the 3rd if you want to read it along with all the other folks and people.
It was an excellent and very strange way to read Bram Stoker's novel. I highly recommend it.
As do I. This is unsponsored, by the way. We just like innovative ways of reading literature.
I just think it's neat. But before we go on any tangents, just in case someone out there doesn't know, Vic, do you want to explain what a Dracula is? What's the story here?
So I think before we get into Dracula, I think we need to go back to a little villa in Geneva where Lord Byron and his friends decided to write a ghost story because the weather was bad, there was a volcanic eruption that year, and basically it was created a whole bunch of, you know, environmental effects that, you know, made it very hard for people to be outside all the time. Essentially though, one of them wrote a little novel, I don't know if you've ever heard of it, called Frankenstein.
Yeah, it's not that famous.
No, not at all. Who's heard of Mary Shelley, daughter of Mary Wollstonecraft, and her very popular father, what's his name?
William...
Godwin, yeah, that dude, yeah. Yeah, the father of anarchy, never heard of her. And the other one wrote one of the others wrote an early vampire story called The Vampire. With a Y, because he was fancy.
And also because no standardized spelling, but mostly because he was fancy.
The image was largely inspired by Lord Byron, John Polidori, who wrote The Vampire. You know, they were buddies, which probably helped build the homoerotic idea of the vampire.
I explained so much.
I mean, I don't blame him. Have you seen Byron's paintings? It's like, he could get it.
I have seen Byron's PR campaign, yes.
Good PR. We still talk about his sex life for some reason.
That PR.
But anyways, the next vampire novel that came out was Carmilla by Sheridan Le Fanu. I hope that I said that right. Frenchie Fry, what do you say?
I couldn't tell you.
Okay. All right. Good. I'm sorry for calling you Frenchie Fry.
I'll take it.
All right. Which, if you haven't heard of Carmilla, you know, is about a lesbian vampire.
Reading Carmilla is a formative experience for a young bisexual bear.
Watching the Carmilla web series adaptation was formative for a young bisexual Vic, and it was also formative for Stoker to read the book.
A young bisexual Stoker? No confirmation!
No confirmation! Did he like men? We don't know. He had some interesting relationships in his life, but we're not gonna talk about that.
This is not the sexuality speculation podcast.
No, it is not. I mean, you can speculate about us. Because...
Well, no, it's not speculation. We just said it.
His story Dracula built on a lot of the already existing vampire stories from these two authors. And there's even a short story. I have the Broadview edition, which has actually a short story by Stoker, which I'm going to go to the end of it here. A. which is a short story called Dracula's Guest. Basically, there's a reference to Carmilla where it says, Countess Dolingen of Graz in Styria sought and found death, 1801. Styria was the place where Carmilla was set. Like, it's not subtle that he saw this as an inspiration.
Okay, so just to go back to Dracula. So Dracula is, essentially, you're saying, a vampire, but it's not the first vampire story. It's a new telling of some of these older conventions, right? And the broad strokes are, if I may take it away, that Jonathan Harker, a fresh-faced English lad, travels to the mysterious country of Transylvania to meet the mysterious Count Dracula, who is, dun dun dun, a vampire! Shocking, I know. Dracula has decided to move to England, and the rest of the story is about Mina, Jonathan's fiancée-slash-wife, and her dear sweet friend Lucy, who also becomes a vampire, and the men who love Lucy banding together to defeat the vile Count. Pretty usual sort of story for vampires.
What is so unique about Dracula is that it came out at a time where rising new technologies were revolutionizing the way people read and wrote. New laws regarding education meant that people were becoming more literate, and with that came an insatiable appetite for stories of all forms. This meant that society saw a rise in print media, such as novels, travel guides, newspapers, and more. Unfortunately, this brought upon issues such as an increase in propaganda and the sensationalization of crimes such as the Ripper Murders. This era saw a lot of murder cases that became infamous mainly because of the literary afterlife they had in the media and in fiction. Even though Stoker was not writing about the Ripper murders, he did base his vampire on a real person, Vlad Tepes, or Dracul, and
there's a lot of criminology tucked away inside this novel, isn't there?
A lot. And a lot of fear of criminality and marginalized groups as well. My mortal enemy, Michel Foucault, would probably...
Foucault!
Fucking Foucault. Yeah. Would probably have something to say about it. He's my enemy simply because he's very hard to read, and I have had to read him a lot over the course of my 2 degrees.
Oof. I feel like this is a good place to start talking about the Gothic. Can we talk about the Gothic? I love talking about the Gothic.
Me too, bro, Trashu. There is nothing I like more than a bit of Gothic stuff.
So, the Gothic came from the latter half of what the English majors like to call the long 18th century. The long 18th century started in the 17th century, which, I know, confusing. I'm not how centuries work. But by the time we creep up on the 1780s to 1790s, we're also starting to edge onto the Romantic period. So that long in 18th century is from about 1640 up until 1780 to 1790. Mm-hmm. And there's so much that I would love to say here about the word Romantic and that whole period and everything involved, but that's a tangent and we won't go there. The Gothic comes from a lot of the same sensibilities as the Romantic, a sort of negative reaction to the heavy-handed logic of the Enlightenment.
And both have had a long life within our pop culture subconscious.
Right, but the first major mainstream Gothic novel was Mysteries of Udolpho, which inspired none other than Jane Austen.
As mentioned in Northanger Abbey, which is a book that lovingly uses Gothic tropes to gently satirize a genre that Jane was very fond of.
To summarize briefly, the Gothic is a genre. There are horrors beyond our comprehension that render us insensible and/or hysterical. Let's explore them.
We like the creepy, the macabre, and the weird as a society. I think people are oftentimes drawn to the dark or spooky media for many reasons, but partially because we like to be scared, because it gives us a rush that makes us appreciate the fact that we are alive, that we can enjoy beauty in the world around us. It's why a lot of people enjoy Gothic or spooky aesthetics, because the thrill is enjoyable.
And we like horror we can put down. There is plenty to be afraid of in real life, and so we like a safe place to explore those feelings of terror, of fear, where we can have them and then put them away. Real life really doesn't let you put the fear away in that same way.
It is hard to find safe places to be scared because being scared insinuates that there is something for us as a society to fear. Acts of violence, the supernatural, and the unknown are topics that continue to inspire pieces of media into the modern era. I work as a scare actor during the fall, and I can tell you that people come for thrills, for a laugh, or to prove things to themselves, which they try to do by trying to scare the actors or just being little shits. People like to prove that they are strong enough to not be frightened in the face of possible danger.
Right, and it's important for fiction to remain a safe place for these explorations. Dracula is a great example of that sort of safe place to be scared of the other, because there's so many different layers of horror to it, so many things that that Stoker wrote in there to be scared of.
I think one of the reasons that Dracula remains so popular is because its themes are very changeable depending on the person reading or adapting it. I think the vampire remains popular because it is such a changeable genre. Initially, the vampire was the symbol of the unknown other, or marginalized groups that society feared. It was a tool of fear and of victimization, but now we are seeing a reclamation of the genre, where vampires are still a symbol of marginalized groups, but in a way that humanizes these people. This can be seen in recent books, films, and TV shows like What We Do in the Shadows, A Diary of Blood, Certain Dark Things, and more. Dracula, however, is a part of the earlier iteration of the vampire, and as such, we need to acknowledge the anti-Semitic and exclusionist language within the text.
It really is so important not to forget that the vampire is based on anti-Semitic stereotyping, which is one of the reasons why so much of the fight against the vampire in this novel relies on Christian religious iconography. The anti-otherness in this text is based on a fear and a hatred of the Jewish people and their culture, which, fun fact, came about because historically people have wanted to remove property, money, land, that sort of thing, from the possession of Jewish people. Likewise, hatred of the Romani people and people who live the sort of traveling lives that this, and I cannot pronounce this,
Sejani
live, comes from a fear of the unknown or unfamiliar and a deep hatred on the part of the church towards people whose lives they can't control. This novel is weirdly Catholic when you think about it.
Especially, like, you know, for a Protestant society.
Especially for a Protestant society.
I don't know if we actually looked into the fact that Is Stoker Catholic?
He was Irish.
Yeah.
Hang on.
Yeah, you Google that.
He was Protestant.
All right.
That's where you should edit to.
Okay. Yes. Thank you. Yes, he was Protestant. Okay. Good to confirm.
Thank you, Bear.
I think Stoker chose to write his story in Transylvania because it's one of those places that did not get a lot of attention at that time, and kind of remains a place of mystery. It is now part of Romania, but the novel has built a sort of mythos around Transylvania that is hard to escape. We should note that for a book that is partially a satire of nonfiction travel narrative, it is not based on the experiences of Stoker. He never actually went there. He based much of his writing on what is now modern Romania on travelogues of the time, going so far as to use illustrations to inspire his idea of Dracula's castle, probably those based on Bram Castle, which is why we say Bram Castle is Dracula's castle.
Mm-hmm.
Partially, you can tell that his writings are based on travelogues, mainly because Stoker's descriptions of paprika being indecently spicy is frankly insulting to my Hungarian-German taste buds, but also Mamaliga is essentially polenta. How spicy can polenta be?
It's got flavor, it's too spicy. But this is an example of Stoker bringing in elements of his period's popular culture. This is when culinary tourism became popular, and, unfortunately, culinary elitism.
Goddamn English!
Culinary colonialism is one of the great evils, yes. But I feel it's worth mentioning that the travelogue and the Gothic novel actually have something of a long history together. The Mysteries of Udolpho, which I mentioned previously, also draws heavily on the travelogue tradition, describing the Alps in gratuitous detail. Like, seriously, there's so much description of mountains, I felt like I could just, like, take that book, go for a walk, and I will have traveled the Alps.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost a given that any Gothic novel will also feature heavy descriptions of whatever the scenery is.
It was a very aesthetic movement.
It was extremely aesthetic.
It's so true. I was also just annoyed, because I've been to Budapest, that Stoker never told us where the convent that Jonathan recuperates in Budapest. What side of the river is he on? Buda or Pest? You know, yeah, you can tell that he was never there because he didn't know the difference between Buda or Pest. There's a difference.
You are the reason why all my stories feature excessive research. I'm writing in Chicago style. For you.
You know what? It's the superior citation style.
Yeah, huh?
Yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. I will fight you on that.
Uh-huh.
As a historian and travel geek as well, and your best friend, I appreciate you. Audience, please know that I'm making loving puppy dog eyes at Clarissa as we speak.
Worse, it's working. It always works.
It's why I say you're one of the best writers I know.
Okay, but let's get back to the poorly researched setting of Dracula.
Fine, I'll stop complimenting you. I get the hint.
on our last podcast together, we talked about the panorama as an example of the desire to travel being fulfilled by sort of a substitution, a simulation, if you will. In the Victorian era, travel logs were seen as a great way to get the culture of a place without the cost of travel, or at least to mimic getting the culture of a place. So Stoker is pulling from this tradition to help create what is supposed to be a rising sense of tension in the first 5 chapters of the novel Dracula.
And I don't blame him for doing that. It's hard to afford a European tour of, you know, Eastern Europe on a theater critic's salary. Or any salary, if you're not, you know, exorbitantly rich.
Incredibly wealthy. But the reason that this travel log inspiration is supposed to create tension in these first few chapters is because the travel log is supposed to be mainly about the place. So when people were reading Dracula in the 1890s, the first few entries in Jonathan's journal would have been familiar as seeming similar to many travelogues they would have read, right up until we meet Count Dracula, or rather, the coachman, who is obviously not Dracula at all.
I think this is also why we see this continuation of using Transylvania in vampiric or supernatural media, because it is both familiar and unfamiliar, and our time is no longer a country of its own. So it's a place that is locked in time and into the supernatural. It's why we have Hotel Transylvania!
It's also not quite the Orient, but not the Orient. Something distinctly non-Western without being distinctly Eastern. But let's leave Edward Said and Orientalism out of this conversation.
True, but also Edward Said does have a lot of good points that we should talk about in a future episode. I think that the reason why the setting for Dracula is so enchanting is because it is so exoticized and mysterious. And that is a problem in itself, because it means that the story revolves around stereotypes and myths in order to create an environment that feels ancient as well as alien, which I have a lot of feelings about.
We've been talking about this in our Augustinian literature course, which is Augustinian literature prior to the long 18th century. That's the literary period immediately before the long 18th century.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been talking about this desire that happens in a lot of fiction, where we want to set horror or other strange things somewhere other than what is quote-unquote home, wherever home might be. So in a sense, Stoker is just following a long tradition of mythologizing, if that's a word. Mythologizing, let's go with it, foreign places in order to create some sense of distance from what is familiar and what is home and comfortable.
In a way, as you said previously, he is building on the traditions of the panorama. He's using an image or stereotype of a place to give the impression of experience, when really it is just ignorance. And I will give Stoker some credit, he did quite a bit of research for his book. However, that research was written from a colonial perspective, specifically the ones that are included in the Broadview edition. Please look at that one if you care to have more information on Dracula and his inspirations. Anyways, but I think that this is an issue that still moves into the present in a lot of travel writings. I think we need more travel writing in the vein of Anthony Bourdain, that is less colonial perspectives and mainly on the lived experiences of the civilians in the country that is being visited.
Anthony Bourdain was an amazing person.
The world lost a great person and a great culinary and cultural anthropologist when he passed away. What I liked about his travel writing and his shows was that he valued the opinions of locals and actually listened. He talked about the political as well as the cultural and culinary environment in the places that he visited. We need more of that. He got into the nitty-gritty and asked questions beyond the ones that were typically asked in a lot of travel writing. He went to places that were uncomfortable. He was not romantic, but honest, and I like that. I think we need more of it.
Especially since so much travel writing, historical or otherwise, focuses on what is quote-unquote exotic or other, and really puts a spotlight on the strange. It's all about being politely revolted in a lot of cases, rather than appreciating what is new or different.
It's like visiting a sideshow. They do not want to actually understand and give empathy. They want to gawk with their mouths open, drooling at the sight of pain and the idea of something different from their own experience. It is why so many travel narratives cater to the elite, because so often travel is outside of the budget of many people.
In Dracula, this really comes through when Jonathan eats paprika Hendel, or chicken paprikash, and basically has fever dreams because it's so spicy. Vic has made me chicken paprikash. It was delicious, and I had no fever dreams. Also, although I'm not the best judge of this, it was not even a little spicy.
I love spicy food. Like, spicy food that will make you cry from agony because your butthole feels the after effects. It is not because I did not want to make it spicy. The recipe I used was authentic, but it was just not spicy.
And I grew up in Southeast Asia, and Vic knows this, so she was not catering to my taste. I have a pretty good spice tolerance, but paprikash was not spicy. It was actually almost sweet.
And our friend Elliot, who has...
White boy.
White boy spice tolerance. White British boy spice tolerance.
White British boy spice tolerance.
He still ate it and did not have issues, so...
Not a tear was shed.
Yeah, it has a smoky sort of sweetness to it. It's just a chicken stew, really, with dumplings. And now I'm getting hungry.
Let's get through this, and then we can make some paprikash together.
Fuck yeah. I cannot wait. Yeah.
We'll get there.
It's a good thing I live by a grocery store, because that makes life much easier if we have paprikash cravings. Perhaps we might even make some polenta and see if we can actually make it spicy.
Oh, spicy polenta. Sounds like an experience.
Yeah, I'm down with that. But speaking of food, culinary history is one of those things I'm really interested in, and I think we should probably talk about how the food in Dracula is a product of the Victorians' changing views on food with the increased trade that occurred during the Industrial Revolution, during rising education rates and imperialism.
We did talk about it a little in our Dickens podcast, but we mentioned cookbooks as a new form of literature. So check that out if you haven't already. Here we're seeing food travel and culinary exploration as part of the culture of the later Victorian period. The world is shrinking in the latter half of the 1800s because of the telegraph, the railway, and the frankly revolutionary effect the railway has on the postal system. You can get recipes from Budapest and places further east. You don't have to hope some dude wandering through will write the recipe down, maybe correctly, and publish it. Your friend, or in this case, your fiancé, can just send it to you.
However, this does not mean the recipes will always be accurate, as there are language barriers and changes in the taste that are often reflected in the text at the time. Mrs. Beaton.
Right. But there's also a greater range of food possibilities after the railway came into service, purely because you could get regional foods outside of their regions of origin. So I'm not just talking about, you know, one part of England prefers to make their dish this way and another prefers to make it this way. I'm talking about ginger, turmeric, fenugreek, all sorts of fancy spices. Now suddenly you can get these things and they're fresher and they're tastier and you're getting them in England, no problem. And the absolute game changer that was the popularization of potatoes, peppers, and tomatoes, all taken from the quote-unquote New World, the Americas, and an unprecedented amount of fusion cuisine that has started coming into being in the late 1800s. This is when curries start showing up in English houses. This is when, I'm sorry, this is not relevant. I love food.
I'm craving curry back now, too. I'm just craving food with spices in it.
Back to Dracula.
Well, speaking of food, Mamaliga, or essentially a corn porridge / polenta, is a result of this sort of interaction. Without realizing, Stoker showed that even though the places Jonathan visited was distinct from Britain, it was also still touched by the effects of the Industrial Revolution's trade. It is subtle, but it is there, even though the depiction of Eastern Europe is quite backwards, with superstitious villagers and vampiric counts, it is still touched by the inescapability of technology.
As Jonathan writes in his journal, he is 19th century up to date with a vengeance. But, and I'm quoting from memory here, there are powers of the past which mere modernity cannot kill. I think that's the quote.
Your ability to memorize quotes is astounding, yeah. And I appreciate the fact that you can do that when I can.
Stoker has all sorts of contrasts like that throughout the novel. Looking at modern life compared to a traditional life, even though his depiction of what is traditional is highly fictionalized.
Yeah. Totally. I cannot help but think about how the English idea of what is spicy has changed over many years. Before spices were commonly available, they were extremely expensive. However, as they became more popular, they were easier to access, making them cheaper for people of the middle to lower classes to afford. This, of course, led people in power to crack down on this by removing the spices they once loved in favor of being able to taste the quality of ingredients.
Quote unquote.
Mm-hmm. Sure, you can taste when certain foods are high quality. Like, say, if you get cream straight from, like, you know, the farmer's market instead of, you know, the grocery store.
I will pause it. One can tell intimately the difference between fresh, good pasta made properly and dried pasta. Not the same.
Agreed.
But
getting back to the topic, just because certain foods are high quality does not mean that all of them are good for not having spices. There is a reason why Britain has a reputation for being bland, and that is partially because they let classicism pick their palate. There is no wonder that Jonathan cannot eat paprika Handel. He's probably never tasted anything spicier than a food with too much salt and pepper.
Well, food is so inherently tied to class, it is insane. Like, crazy. Like, have you ever thought about lobster?
Yeah.
Sorry, no. Brief aside. Lobster, everybody saw it as a sea bug, right up until they started serving it in, like, fancy restaurants, and then all of a sudden it became so expensive you could not buy lobster to save your life.
Same thing with oysters and mussels and stuff.
Yeah. A lot of British stereotypical foods, and American stereotypical foods, come from lower classes trying to match what the upper classes are doing, and the upper classes trying their best to avoid being anything like lower classes. Kind of an endless cycle of classism. Making worse and worse dishes all the time.
It's the same way across the world, and especially here in North America. A lot of famous American food came from immigrant groups and marginalized groups that only suddenly becomes popular and expensive when it becomes the cool thing to try something exotic. You can see this in the Italian food scene.
I think we're getting away from the point. I love you. I want to talk about this with you, but we're Dracula.
We'll talk about this later, you and I.
We will. Very interesting, but a tangent nonetheless, my love.
True that, but I do think it is important we acknowledge the layers in Stoker's text, as food colonialism and the travelogue cannot be separated in this instance.
They really can't. I mean, they can't be separated generally. However, the travelogue is really only the first few chapters. Let's talk about something a little further into the book. Like, not that much further on, but a little bit. Let's talk about Dracula's castle and the gothic horror of it all. I think for many modern readers, it's hard to see the tension in these first Jonathan Journal chapters. We know Dracula is a vampire. There's no mystery there.
I think that's probably because a lot of media around Dracula has become a separate entity from the book itself. And from our buddy Jonathan Harker. How many times do we
our
see...
Our good friend, Jonathan Harker.
Our poor good Johnny boy.
Our poor dumb genre-blind Johnny.
It is no longer tense for us because we all know that Dracula is the bad guy from all the media that we have watched. And we don't care about Jonathan Harker, unfortunately, because a lot of Dracula-inspired media takes out Jonathan.
Yeah, it really strips him of his agency. But Dracula suffers from what I like to call the Matrix problem. Now, I did not watch The Matrix until I was 20 years old. This is because I'm allergic to television. I didn't like it. I found it boring. I thought Neo was a dull, flat character, and that the plot was something I'd seen a million times before, especially with that sort of character, and then I realized, oh god, of course I have. The Matrix came up with this particular plot and character archetype combination, and it's been popular ever since. But like Dracula, The Matrix was the first of its type. So when people read Dracula and say, oh, it's just like all these other things, it's important to remember that these other things are echoing Dracula, not the other way around. Alas for Dracula, it is spoiled by its successors.
I think we are starting to see that as well with things like The Hunger Games or Bridgerton, which I'm like... Oh, killing myself for saying that instead of Jane Austen, but I'm like, look, sure we're seeing a hype around Jane Austen, but that really only kicked in again after Bridgerton came out. So when something is popular, people are going to want to capitalize on that, even though that might not make good art in the process. For example, Persuasion, the new Netflix adaptation. Sorry, like Persuasion, which tried to be an ungodly amalgamation between Jane Austen and Fleabag. It was bad. It was really, really bad, because it wasn't Persuasion. And I have opinions on it. I'll probably do an episode on that in the future. So, tangent. But it had the possibility to be good, but when you do not understand why the source material was enjoyable, or what elements made that source material enjoyable, it can lead for subsequent iterations in the genre to feel lackluster.
I guess I should really call it the Dracula problem, since Dracula came first, but you know what? I think it's funnier if I keep calling it the Matrix problem.
I mean, Keanu Reeves appears immortal, so who's to say he is not the Dracula problem and the Matrix problem?
It's the Keanu problem.
It's Keanu. Keanu is everything. Keanu is love. Keanu is life. I think this all leads us into...
Live, laugh, Keanu Reeves.
That's going to be the quote of the episode. I think, though, this leads us into a discussion on Dracula's impact on us as a society. We're still seeing Dracula adaptations and homages in books, TV, films, comics, RPGs, and more.
Every piece of media.
Every piece of media. I'm literally going to be Dungeon Master for a Curse of Strahd campaign.
I'm so excited.
Yeah, you get to be one of my players. I'm so excited.
I'm so excited.
Yeah, if I ever do, like, an episode about, like, you know, DMing, we'll have to talk about that. With the campaign, you know, you have to read through this book, and they talk about the process of writing the campaign. And they talked about, of course, Dracula and the media that inspired it, as we discussed, because vampiric media seems to build on top of itself. It's like a layer cake. And so we see that in other things as well. So recently we saw the release of The Inheritance, which played at being a horror when arguably it was a failed gothic romance. That film took a lot of inspiration from Dracula, specifically with the names chosen for some of the characters and the place names. However, it was not a straight adaptation at all. But what I liked about it was that it took the idea of the vampire standing in for the marginalized and replaced that as being symbolic of the aristocracy, which is vampiric in nature, because it, you know, takes away from those below them.
Those bloodsuckers.
Yes.
We make those jokes.
Yeah.
There is so much symbolism in having the vampire be a part of the oppressor class rather than an outclass. Woof.
Do you want to go through that again?
Yeah. There is so much symbolism in having a vampire be part of the oppressor class rather than an outcast, but that's just not where Stoker went with Dracula. Count Dracula in this text is so distinctly othered that it becomes hard to read him as sexy in the way that a lot of adaptations seem to really, really want to. I think Dracula Daily was a pretty good showcase of that particular aspect of the original novel. Because the reading public, and it was quite popular last year, to a person decided to hate Dracula and love on our good friend Jonathan Harker. And, of course, to love on Jonathan's lovely fiancé/wife, Mina. But in this book, Stoker is showcasing all the fears of what is other in his culture through the person of Dracula, and it is wild to see.
It is. All the memes that were coming out on Dracula Daily were entertaining in a lot of ways. But they also showed how much of Stoker's original text has been slowly covered up by a hazy curtain that is society's idea of what Dracula is.
Stoker was not going for a sexy vampire! He just wasn't! He wasn't!
He climbs on the wall like a lizard! If I did that in the sight of my partner, I think he'd be pretty damn frightened.
I don't know, he's pretty good at rolling with the punches, and no kink shaming, but going out in his lizard fashion is rarely what you want to hear about somebody you think of as sexy.
I mean, I do have a shirt that says "Don't kink shame Dracula" with a picture of him crying.
For all that it wasn't a spectacularly sexy book, I have to say, there were no sex scenes, but Dracula is, like, deeply kinky. It is a deeply kinky book.
No, I mean, biting necks, not kinky at all.
Nope, that bit where the brides of Dracula come for Jonathan. The candles dripping sperm. The candles, literally, they are described as sperm-like drippings at one point. Mina and Jonathan are hard at it with the typewriters, and that doesn't seem like a very comfy sexed position.
That sounds painful. Also, that took me a second, but I got the point. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, there's a lot here that looks at Victorian sexuality, but more than that, at Victorian kinksuality? Kinks. Kinkiness.
Kinky.
Sort of the Victorian anxieties around sex and, like, the distinctions they put on public and private life and that sort of thing, if any of that makes sense. It's also just really not a straight novel.
Not at all. I'm sorry, I'm just like, how does Dracula climb? Like, is it with his claws? Like, does he have the little things on his fingers like Tobey Maguire and Spider-Man? Sorry, that is what
he's all the way down, too, in that scene in the novel. He's crawling headfirst down.
I'm just picturing, like, Tobey Maguire-style Spider-Man in a red cape.
Right? Does the cape flip upside down?
Is it flapping in his face?
I need to know.
I'm gonna just create an art of this, and that's just gonna be the episode art, is
Dracula getting tangled up in his cape because gravity's a thing?
Tobey Maguire as Dracula, with a cape flopping in his face.
If we were looking for an appropriately unsexy Dracula.
Yes, well, the Victorians were kinky, but they hide it very well, and I agree there's a lot of homoerotic subtext in the text, especially between Mina and Lucy.
And also between Jonathan and Dracula, especially during the first bit.
Totally. Dracula seems menacing and charming in a way that seems almost flirtatious at times. Even though he's not described, he's described in a way that does not make him sound sexy. I honestly pictured the hunter from Jumanji as Dracula when, like, he's first introduced. So now I'm picturing an ungodly amount of getting hit of Tobey Maguire's body upside down with his fingers on the wall, the cape flapping his face, and it's a Van Pelt's face from Jumanji.
Yes, agreed. Dracula is horny, not sexy. There's a difference, and it's an important one. Let's shift away from Dracula the dude. And let's talk about Mina and Lucy.
Yes, let's. I think it's interesting. Sorry.
We're gonna need a second to decompress from that one.
I'm sorry, that wasn't expected, but I'm glad we talked about that. Okay, I'm like massaging my jaw, guys, because I can't stop. Okay.
Deep breath.
I think it's interesting to see how Carmilla's influence comes out here in the text. In this situation, Lucy becomes both Laura and Carmilla. If you haven't read Carmilla, it is by a young girl named Laura who meets another named Carmilla after a carriage accident. They recognize one another from a dream and subsequently begin an acquaintanceship. Over time, Laura becomes ill and it becomes clear that Carmilla may not be who she claims to be. Laura is eventually saved, but this is where, like, the stories differ. Lucy begins the story as a woman whose main problem seems to be that she cannot choose between her suitors, a situation that could have probably been benefited from a polyamorous relationship, but Stoker and the Victorian period are not ready for that.
And I mean, honestly, polyamory is not the cure for everything. It is the cure for some things, but not everything.
But she did say that she wished
she could marry, yes.
Yeah, so...
Very cruel of people to force her to marry one man.
Exactly. However, she's plagued by sleepwalking and dreams, gradually becoming ill and succumbing. She then becomes a vampire who, like Carmilla, preys on young people who cannot defend themselves from the Blufer Lady. And so she is technically saved in the end, like Laura, but by being killed.
By being murdered. It's also, Mina and Lucy are a very classic case of the Victorian new woman, traditional woman dichotomy, which we've seen in other texts in this class. I don't think we've talked about it on the podcast, though.
No.
You get this sort of contrast between a very delicate, silly woman who is attracted to men and her companion, who is inevitably a sturdy, sensible woman who doesn't seem to attract any attention whatsoever.
God forbid we have strong women with educations and sexual appetites who want to have a role in society other than wife and mother.
We can't have new women who aren't women, and women are mothers first and foremost, obviously.
Their wombs will wonder, and then how else will we create more spawn?
So in this case, we have Mina, who is described as having a man's mind, in contrast to the lovely, sweet, much pursued, and ultimately doomed Lucy. Tragic. And they are quite close. A pair of gals being pals, if you will.
Two girls sitting in a bathtub 10 feet apart because they're not gay.
Two girls sitting on a gravestone? I digress.
Hot, bubbling pool of candle wax.
Ew. I'm revoking your innuendo privileges.
Dang it. But wait, this is my podcast!
Vetoed!
I think we'll have to take this issue to the manager!
Tangent! Back on topic. The definitely not sapphic relationship between Mina and Lucy is... Sorry. The definitely not sapphic relationship between Mina and Lucy is the catalyst for, like, most of the plot.
Yep, so much plot. So much plot. One of the things we've not really discussed... Yeah, we both need to recover. We're getting kind of loopy here.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a long day.
I'm very tired.
Yeah, we both are. I mean, we came here from school. I had a, like, 15-minute nap. Daylight savings. Or...
Let's just shift by half an hour and then call it good.
Yeah.
For the rest of time.
Yeah, exactly. One of the things we have not really discussed in this episode but did in class is the usage of technology throughout the text. Specifically, telegrams, the railway, steamships, the typewriter, the phonograph, and more. One of the reasons this is important is because this novel is epistolary in nature, meaning that it comes in the form of diaries, letters, and more. As readers, we are aware that the edited manuscript is a fiction, but in the story world, it is a tool for survival. As discussed in our class, it is Mina's idea to record as much data as possible so that the group of vampire hunters can hunt down Dracula with as much information as they need. She writes down most of the letters and the phonograph diary from Dr. Seward so that we can, and they can, understand what is going on. Essentially, she's a girl after my historian's heart.
This really ties back to my first point about Dracula Daily when we were talking about it being kind of out of order. Mina, in fiction, puts the narrative together. She explicitly states, in chronological order. But in reality, there are places where it jumps back and forth because she puts all of Jonathan's journals together and she puts all of her letters to Mina together and she puts her journal together. We see the same time period covered from different perspectives, which is very effective as a tool for the narrative. But when I was reading Dracula Daily, it was a little confusing to be in Dracula's castle, tense as all hell, waiting to find out what happened to Jonathan, and then to be in Whitby with Mina and Lucy having a good old time with my gal pals.
Yeah, we're just hanging out in our hot tub full of candle wax.
I hate you.
you love me.
I do.
Just hanging out together, gals being pals. But yeah, it's weird, and I think that's why Stoker's story is not intended to be serialized, because it doesn't make sense when you take it out of, like, in a way, Mina is a historian.
Mina is certainly a archivist.
Archivist, historian.
Yes. I think it's also quite interesting to read into this novel the anxieties about technology that Bram Stoker so clearly had.
Yes.
Because we have the phonograph, Dr. Seward's phonograph, where he records all of his diary, where he talks about Renfield. But according to Mina, the sound of him talking is too much. It's too personal. It's too lifelike.
It's the uncanny valley. And thing is, we're doing this right now in a way. We're Dr. Seward.
We are Dr. Seward. And how would we go back if we were Dr. Seward and did not have digital technology to pick out one part of this podcast to listen to again and again? I mean, of course, you're gonna have to do that as the editor.
Yeah.
But if all you could do was play from the beginning again, it would be really hard to sort of tag when you talk about specific things.
Yeah.
And so Bram Stoker's novel, by contrasting the phonograph with the typewriter, takes the typewriter out of the new and into the old.
Yeah.
Which is really cool.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And I mean, what's also interesting is that Jonathan takes along a camera with him.
Never mentioned again.
Never mentioned again.
One line, he takes a Kodak camera. Never mentioned again.
And it's so interesting that it's like a Kodak camera, because, you know, you picture the Kodak in the modern era as, like, you know, this very famous camera company. But now it's like, wow, this was new at this time.
Yeah.
And it's so interesting. I'm just imagining, what if Dracula was, like, not only, like, you know?
One of Bram Stoker's original ideas for the novel had that Dracula could not be photographed. That every photograph either became someone else or showed a skeleton. I know,
so
right?
Good. That's just reminding me of what we do in the shadows. Except it's like, you know, they can take pictures of each other, but it's when they're trying to figure out how they look before going out, they have to draw a picture of one another. So it's, how do I look? I don't know. You look like this. And it's a very shoddily drawn thing. And, I mean, it's great. They all look dead but delicious.
It's a good descriptor.
That is a quote from the film. I wish I came up with that myself, but no.
It's a good descriptor. So, technology. Travel. Tiny, tiny world people are now living in. You can order flowers from Amsterdam.
Yeah.
And get them delivered the next day because the trains are that good. That's crazy. That's insane to think about. I'm team trains. I'm team train supremacy.
Yes.
I'm team trains.
I had a whole conversation with Sean about trains the other day.
We need more trains.
We need so many trains. I would love to take a train ride across Canada, but we can't do that.
My butt would go numb because CP Rail does not care about their passengers.
No, they need to update the railways here in Canada.
I'd love to take a train to Calgary for a day.
That would be great.
That'd be great. But, tangent, mere modernity cannot kill. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that line. That line shows up in, I think, the second or third chapter.
Yeah.
It is not that far in. And it really, we've talked about it in class, it really encapsulates Bram Stoker's sort of anxieties about about technology, about the past, about the future, about what's going on, and it captures what ultimately fails to happen. The vampire hunters work with technology and do their best, but it isn't technology that defeats the vampires. It's good old-fashioned shootouts.
Yep. It's full-on violence. It's like, you have this D&D campaign almost, where everyone is like, they're very improv, they're very political-centric, and it's just, oh yeah, we're gonna have to fight this one out, send out the monk with his fist.
Yeah! Ah! Send out our sharpshooter, our one sharpshooter. R.I.P. Yeah. Quincy Morris.
R.I.P.
You will be missed.
Yeah. That's what you get for not having a paladin.
That's what you get for not having a paladin. It's very interesting to me that you can read Bram Stoker's novels as something that's very pro-technology, or you can read it as something that's mildly anti-technology. He doesn't love the phonograph. He doesn't really talk about the photograph. He talks about the typewriter almost as an invasion of privacy.
Mm-hmm.
So Mina's typing up and chronological gathering, her archiving of this information, is in and of itself a violation of privacy. It's a violation of privacy between her and Lucy, their private letters, of Jonathan's private journal, of Dr. Seward's private diary, and it's all very carefully collated, cataloged, chronologically arranged, and displayed.
Yeah, and I mean, it's also an invasion. It's also an invasion of privacy for Dracula. He literally goes out of his way to try and destroy it. But Mina sees the value of having this information copied, so she has multiple copies. I think one of the things we need to consider is, like, we're only getting the colonial perspective on this. We're not getting the immigrant perspective.
And it's from a time period where, let's just say, prisoners' rights weren't really a big deal. There were a few champions for prisoners' rights. And this is a text that relies very heavily on criminology and on criminal psychology and on that new science of criminal theory. Dracula discusses its main character as a criminal. It talks about what he would do because he's a criminal. He's a murderer. He's a killer. And so they're using that lens to inspect this vampire. And a lot of modern adaptations, I think, lose that sort of lens. They don't really talk about, you know, he's a criminal.
Yeah.
At his core.
Yeah, and what I think is interesting about this is that this book came out in the years after the Dreyfus Affair, which I don't know if you know what that is. So basically, there was this high-ranking person in the French military named Dreyfus, and he was falsely accused of being a traitor. And so he's charged, he was stripped of all of his military, like, stuff, and then he was basically left in exile in horrible conditions for many years.
Left to rot, as it were.
Until it was actually proved that another person in the military had actually done this. But this is one of those events that, it seems small, but it was a catalyst for a lot of anti-Semitism in France, in Europe, and across the world.
England has a very, very long history of being extremely anti-Semitic.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of it. Like, a really long, like, we could talk about Harry Potter here. We won't. We could. We won't. Yeah. But we could.
Thank you. Yes. And, I mean, Dreyfus, he was Jewish. And so, you see, like, this person who is being pursued for being Jewish. And then we're seeing this rising anti-Semitism. We're seeing pogroms.
Second World War did not come out of nowhere.
No.
Unfortunately.
No, and nor did the First World War. We saw the lead up to this in the 1890s. We're seeing an arms race. And we're also seeing people being scapegoated. We're seeing marginalized groups, like Jewish people, being kicked out of their homes, being murdered.
An intensification of the othering of these groups.
Yes, and many of them would go to England. There is a large population of Jewish people in East London at this time.
Yeah, it is one of the few places where there are not literally laws against them moving there.
Yeah. And so,
which, fun fact, passports in America were created to control the movements of Jewish people.
Yeah.
Yeah, anti-Semitism has a very long and storied history, and it is something to inspect because as uncomfortable as it makes us to talk about, it needs to be talked about because otherwise we're just going to keep doing it.
Yes, and as a historian, we need to figure out how to talk about these things better because a lot of people don't want to talk about how anti-Semitism fuels so many aspects of our society, specifically in film and television. Going back to Dracula, Nosferatu, the image of the Jewish person, it's literally a racist caricature.
How many vampires can you think of that have the same distinctive profile that is attributed to a lot of Jewish people?
Yeah.
Most of them?
Most of them.
I think it's most of them. Also, this is why I have a bit of an issue with depictions that show vampires being harmed by something like the Star of David, because that feels like you're taking it in the wrong direction. We have to acknowledge that this story, and many others, were often stories of good Catholics triumphing over evil Jewish people. And that's a terrible story.
It is a terrible story.
That's a terrible story, but it's one we've been fond of telling for a couple dozen centuries now. And so when we tell these stories again and we just flip up which religion is defeating the evil, we don't actually go down to the root of what is happening. So if I were to read a story about a Jewish vampire, I should hope they say the mourner's prayer over this Jewish vampire, because that would put them to rest, because that is part of the heritage of being Jewish. Not that I'm Jewish, not that I know all that much about being Jewish, but it is so clearly that the good Catholic men and the virtuous Catholic women preside over this evil other that is very clearly subtextually Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
And it's incredibly anti-Semitic, right to its core.
It is, and we cannot ignore that at all. I say good Christian, just because, as we said,
it's the Eucharist, though.
It is, yes. But I've had Eucharist as a Protestant.
I guess.
Well, I'm Anglican, but I...
And the crosses? I don't know. I was reading much more Catholicism into that than Protestantism. But I guess Bram Stoker does never specify.
Yeah, so, we do have crosses in Anglican and Protestant churches. It's just not to the point where, the crucifix.
Not so common to wear them, I didn't think.
I got some, actually.
Well, so, there you go.
I'm not the most religious person either, because I'm very religiously confused. We're not gonna get into that.
I have a cousin who's a nun, and another who's a priest, and yet I have divorced the Catholic Church, because the Catholic Church is, how do I phrase this?
Not good. We are at 110 minutes.
Okay.
So I think we should wrap up. So, how do we wrap this up? Because...
How do we feel about Dracula?
I think it's an interesting text. And in the past, I have enjoyed it, but, the more I think into it, the more problems I see with it. And, like you said, there's... You might read something or watch something and find it kind of lackluster compared to more modern iterations, because I'm comparing Dracula in my head mentally to What We Do in the Shadows, Certain Dark Things by Silvia Moreno García, The Inheritance, which it's not a fantastic movie, but it puts marginalized voices at the front of the story, makes them the heroes and not the villains. And I think that's important. And I think it's also important that the one of the creators of What We Do in the Shadows, Taika Waititi, is Jewish and Maori.
Yeah. If I were to sum up how I feel about Dracula, I have to say that I am glad that it gave us such rich soil in which to plant our new ideas. But much like manure, it is horse shit.
Yes. Yeah. We can.
So I appreciate it for what it is. I appreciate that we're reading it in an English class, especially in a structured setting where we can talk about the problems with it. It is important also not to fall into the trap of, oh my god, this is an evil book, burn it, burn it, burn it, burn it, burn it. Don't burn books. It has its value. I love Mina as a character.
Mina is fascinating. And similarly with Carmilla, is not a good iteration, or is not a good representation of LGBTQ people in media. But what I love, what came out of it, is the Carmilla web series, which is an incredible piece of media, even though the first season was basically an extended ad for Kotex. It's funny, look it up. But it like you said, it's a foundation. It's a soil to build up upon, but we can have something better.
We can have something better. I think that if we're going to talk about Victorian new media in this is a good distillation of some of the anxieties around new media in the Victorian period.
Yeah, I think so too.
I think we should wrap up there.
Yes.
We are over time.
We are way over time. So you can find me on social media. You cannot find Clarissa.
You can't find me. If you find me, you didn't.
No. You have to summon Clarissa from a book by,
You have to do a pentagram.
Yeah.
You have to choose the appropriate color of candle, which I will not tell you.
Yeah.
You have to choose the appropriate symbols, which I will not tell you.
And then you have
to write the true name of the bear.
Yes. Yes, the true name of the bear. That is important. That is very important.
And then you may summon me.
Yes.
And I may or may not show up.
That is the question. Whereas with me, you can find me on social media on Instagram at Victoria with a K Reads Books. You can also find me on Twitter and TikTok under Victoria with a K Reads Books. But you can also find the podcast Instagram at Lit with Vic Podcast. Wow. Amazing. That is LitWithVicPodcast. Wow, that was hard to spell mentally. Huh.
I believed in you and you did it.
I did it. I'm not going to say Victoria with the K Reads Books. It'll all be in the description. Thank you all for listening to this. Thank you to Dr. Martin for teaching this course. It was a lot of fun.
It was so much fun. And go listen to every podcast that Vic has put out, whether I'm in it or not.
Thank you. We both know you're going to come back. And
I will be here again.
Stay tuned for us to have more episodes together with more friends, because we've got some plans.
See how many queers we can fit in this closet.
It's going to be a tight fit.
It's an obligatory queers in the closet joke.
At least it's not queers in a hot tub full of boiling hot wax.
Oh my god, I'm leaving!
Okay, with that, goodbye, everyone. Love you, and good day.